Morning everyone, it's Mao Sen from PMG.
Quite very minor. Of the policy decision. Is only defining but more important in what has been defined in terms of responding to some of the challenges outlined in the report. Because it's all well and good to say here the findings, here the challenge, but what is most important for us as a ministry, as a department, is to demonstrate what we have done and what we try to do in order to address the magnitude of the problem. Now, just to start off in terms of the introduction, the minister appointed this committee to investigate the issue of student accommodation that he took office in 2009. And this has actually visited a number of institutions, and he saw that there were serious challenges in relation to the provision of both on and off campus accommodation. Because the focus is just not on what universities are doing, because you will see as we present our findings that universities on their own cannot address the magnitude of the problem. It's big and doesn't only require universities to respond to the challenges. What the minister did is concerned that there is lack of adequate as well as affordable. And affordable here is the key word. Because it's no use providing accommodation which is unaffordable to the majority of our students. The majority of our students are from poor and some middle-class families. And if you cannot provide them with affordable accommodation, it doesn't really assist in terms of their academic development. And then what was also quite interesting to note is that between 2005 and 2010, there were a total of about 39 incidents of student-related protests in some of our universities. And needless to say, most of these were in historically black institutions. But I need to emphasize that not all universities are responded to, particularly the issue of student protest. So there are about 15 universities that specifically responded in terms of the questionnaire. So, and even the SRC and some of the stakeholders that the committee engaged with acknowledge that the number 39 is actually unsafe. So the problem is that it's far more than less than 39 demonstrated in the report. And I think it's a matter of what constitutes a student demonstration, what constitutes a report. If a student moves from their residence to the vice chancellor's office and it doesn't meet the newspaper, the university might not regard it as a serious protest. So that is why the number is a bit understated. So the minister immediately appointed Professor Hensen to lead a committee to assess the provision of student accommodation. And the committee has indicated to work led by Professor Hensen. It's also comprised of Mr. in advance on my left, and another committee member who unfortunately could not be here with us, and then the committee had to also make sure that it sources the required expertise, and that is how Dr. Ian Lance, as well as some of the other researchers, got involved in the work of the committee. But it's all well and good to commission a committee to produce the report. What is it that we find to do as a department? What is it that we find to do as a ministry? First and foremost, we try to establish the state of the student accommodation challenges. I think it's about measuring it, quantifying it, so that we can respond on a systematic level, and it's a more coordinated approach. And it's also to offer a well-motivated and a justifiable differentiated framework. The reality is that not all 22 universities that are contact universities face the same challenge. Therefore, you need to differentiate them in terms of their approach. And towards the end of our presentation, I will specifically outline how we differentiate in terms of how we are addressing the challenge of student accommodation. But also, we realize that the numbers that we will be quoting quite today are quite staggering. And we know that there is something. Therefore, we need to come up with medium as long as long-term interventions to make sure that we systematically address the challenge. But first, most important, which is even first prize for the department, is to make sure that we provide in terms of the minimum norms and standards for students accommodated. And it should not be only for on-campus accommodation. It should also be for off-campus accommodation. When the minister released the report, he made a very simple example, but which has profound impact in terms of academic development of students. confined to the case of the students that reside in Army Lodi and study at the University of Johannesburg. On average, it's about 82 kilometers from Army Lodi to Johannesburg. But the minister demonstrated that it takes that student almost 34 hours every day commuting from home to the university. 3 to 4 hours every day translates to about 20 hours per week. And if we are serious about making sure that we improve throughput and success, students should be focusing most of their activities in terms of their academic development, not commuting to and from home. Because it's a huge weight in terms of our limited governmental resources. It's a huge weight in terms of the academic ability of those students. So I will immediately now hand over to Dr. Bielman to go specifically into the findings as well as the recommendations. And I'll come in towards the end in terms of the department's response to their findings. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Honorable Chair, honorable members of the DHGT and colleagues, thank you very much for affording the opportunity to, first of all, participate in this research, which was, I think, really significant in the light of the higher education landscape in South Africa. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to the report today. As Chai has mentioned, I'm going to be speaking, first of all, taking you through the methodology that we adopted in compiling the report, the findings of the committee, and the recommendations. So in terms of methodology, what we did was started by compiling a comprehensive questionnaire which covered 8 key areas of resident life, which was sent to the vice chancellors of all 22 universities. And when I say comprehensive, the questionnaire was some 40 pages long, uncompleted. So it was intended to be a thorough assessment, or to give the institution an opportunity to thoroughly self-reflect, if you like, through the questionnaire. The second component of the methodology was obviously to do a review of related literature, primarily we want to see what literature there is available in South Africa, then the other emerging countries, and then lastly looking at the developed world. I'll mention it now, as we mentioned again later, to emphasize we were astonished at the dearth or the lack of research in this area in our own country, as well as in Africa. We approached the Union of African Universities. We actually couldn't find a single paper that had been written by South Africans and Africans related to the issues that we were researching, which I think is a flag for us as a sector. So we did a comprehensive desktop review of the literature. Then, very importantly, we followed up the questionnaire with a site visit to every single campus, university campus. There was some debate in the committee at the time whether we actually needed to do this, and the view expressed, well, sure, we should just follow. However, as the committee will be aware, as a result of the mergers, we have institutions that have come together where you have, for instance, a campus that is in the urban area, in a metro area. The same university will have a campus in a rural area. Okay. And so I think that is one of the strengths of the research methodology that we adopted, was to visit every single campus in university campus in South Africa. Also, again, free us from the complexity of the example, because we survey the entire population. During those interviews, during those site visits, we interviewed key stakeholders on campus to verify the report or questionnaire submitted by the institution. So we interviewed, we started with the vice chancellor, we spoke to the DEC or the chief directors related to student housing. But very importantly, we also insisted on meeting with the SRC and the student leadership to, if you like, triangulate what the institutions had indicated in the questionnaire. And then obviously we had a session of compiling the data, reviewing it and analyzing it. And one of the things that I'd like to emphasize is that we gave the institution four opportunities, or we had four iterations with the institution to interact with the data that they had submitted. So we would have both from the team and from the department side, we gave the institution every opportunity to make sure that the data that they submitted was in fact correct. Right, let's look to the literature review, and I'll give you a brief summary of what we found in the literature. As I've already indicated, virtually 99.9% of the literature relating to student housing emerges from North America, Europe, and Australia. So, again, a flag that there is a serious lack of research in this area in our own country, and it's something that we need to address. So back at the same point, there's a paucity or a huge shortage of student housing research in developing countries. Arriving out of the literature review, we found that the shortage of student accommodation is not restricted to our country at all. And in fact, across the globe, there is a significant shortage of suitable student accommodation. We also observed that even in the big developed countries, the public funding of higher education is under increasing pressure. In terms of models, we wanted to see if there were any interesting models of student housing out there, innovative models that we utilize in South Africa. We found a couple, as I mentioned on the slide, but I think that we have already introduced in South Africa. The one issue that is emerging more and more in the literature is that residences are not just paid to get students or accommodated. So if you forgive the terminology, residences are not just about buying their heads. Residences are far more than that. And I think that realization lies at the key of this report. And on what the DG mentioned earlier. If you regard residences or hospitals as purely places to accommodate students, I suggest that you will continue to have the kind of problems that we have in the country regarding student housing. The residences actually must form an integral part of the academic project of a higher education institution or tertiary institution. The other issue that we discovered was that there is absolutely no legislation governing or regulating student accommodation in South Africa. We searched the national, the provincial and regional or municipal legal structure and were unable to find any reference to student housing in particular. And this opposed to, for instance, Great Britain, where there is a highly developed code which was driven by the Deputy Prime Minister's office at the time. The United States also developed a code governing student accommodation. In terms of the student data itself, in other words, analyzing the data that the universities have sent to us, I've just collected a couple of interesting findings, if you like, from the data analysis. And the first is the issue of who's in and who's out. So who stays in residence, who doesn't stay in residence. So in terms of race and gender, you see the pie chart on the board. And in fact, as the chair of the committee remarked in his introduction to the report, it's good to see that the bulk of, or the biggest proportion of students in residence are in fact black females. What about black males? But the female component is bigger. The next slide illustrates the demographic proportions in residence, comparing the the demographic grouping against the South African population is the blue line, the university demographic breakdown, in other words, the total enrollment at the university is the orange or red line, and then in residence is the green line. And you can see that largely we reflect the demographics of the country. In terms of the geographic rotation, where do our students come from? This is quite interesting because we can see that in 2010, the bulk of our students in residence came from KZN, followed by the Eastern Cape, followed by SADC. Very interesting findings. In terms of proportions of students by academic year in residence, this is a critical finding and actually quite a disturbing slide, because you'll see that as a proportion of total enrollment at universities in the period 2008-2010, you'll see that first year over there formed the lowest proportion, and in fact only 5% over that period were accommodating residents. The reason why I'm claiming that at a point of huge concern is that first year students are the most vulnerable students coming into residence. They're most vulnerable in terms of their academic capital, if you like, as well as social capital. And I think the committee took this issue very seriously and is reflected in our recommendations. Okay, in terms of our criticism, we thought that if we get the time to show you in photographs, speak far louder than words. What we encountered. And so, in fact, the photographs are juxtaposed in that you'll find the first second of the photograph is of campus environment, if you like, that we encountered. So on one side we'll have a campus that looks like that, and then a campus that looks like that. Again, campus, totally different campus, that kind of environment, and a campus that looks like that. The photograph is not particularly clear. In this particular one, this illustrates the issue that the DC raised earlier about the horrendous effect of some of our buildings. That is white sewage running down the outside of that building. When I spoke to the students indicated to me, I visited this particular institution around about June in 2011. That has been going on since the beginning of the year. The stench in that courtyard was unimaginable. These are a collage of photographs of the student rooms that we encountered. Again, on the left hand side, those are rooms that we encountered at a particular institution. Largely 12 to 14 square meters, very pleasant surroundings for students to learn. On the right hand side, you can see at this particular institution, the room is so small that the door won't even open. And the head of the bed is against that wall, the foot of the bed is against the other wall. So that is the space in which that student must live and study. At another institution, and again, to really touch on this, at this institution, they don't have informal catering, so the students self-cater. The way that institution is provided for that is by simply providing students with hot plates in their room. Now, you can imagine, honorable members, because firstly, that that building was very designed to have a hot plate in every room. Secondly, where those students wash their face and pots and pans? In the toilet. There is no provision made for a place for that stone to be anywhere other than on the floor. Then the other thing that we encountered, and that is a photograph that I have noticed that we encountered in one of the residences, in one of the institutions, and it's a notice by a student appealing to other students who had off space in residence, saying, please, if you go to space, contact me because I want to sublet from you. Okay? Now that is a picture that is originally designed as a double room. So you can see that that is the partition between the one side of the room and the other side of the room. So the room was originally designed for two students. In the room, you have one, two, three, four on that side and four on the other side. So there are eight students being accommodated in a room that is designed for two. And by the way, honorable members, they are expected to cook in that room. And so when we visited some of these institutions, we visited in late-ish afternoon, the students there had to queue to be able to eat. So the amount of time that they spend in cooking and preparing food is significant. As a result of that overcrowding, that is the kind of situation that our students are encountering, for instance, in the ablution area. Okay. Now, in my interactions with the management of the institutions, I mean, the managers are all absolutely dead against squatting. When I interacted with the student leadership also acknowledged the problem being created by squatting. But what they said was, if we don't submit to our comments, please, you go and look the kind of accommodation that our comrades, our brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, friends have to live in if we don't allow them to squat. And that is the kind of situation. This is off-campus private accommodation that is being provided to students. I mean, this case was simply gone. I cannot imagine that students could ever, ever produce any academic output living under these conditions. But the reality is that unless students in official university residences, they are subject to death. And that was just one of many, many such encounters during the cycle. And in fact, this is a set, a series of slides that was provided to the department subsequent to the publication of the report, where this particular institution, namely the University of Venda, is actually confirming the findings of the report. And they provide us these photographs, saying, we verify what you say. So I think this series of photographs, more than anything in the report, shows the honourable members the horrific reality which many of our students are facing in the country. The other comment that I want to make is that I indicated in the first few slides that we showed you some of the campuses which are in reasonable shape or good shape, and on the other side, campuses which are in horrific state. This was one of the key findings of the committee, was the divide is along historic advantage. ready for reality. The committee is simply saying that's our time. We're saying that's the reality confronting the country at the moment. We need to find a solution. We need to address that reality. Whatever the cost, that is the reality. Now the other issue that hit us in the face as researchers, and this was not part of the brief or the terms of reference given by the minister, and it really shocked and astounded us, and that was the issue of student hunger. How many students we encountered in higher education institutions who are literally starving. At one institution that I visited, I encountered, and this again was round about May, I encountered where the residence manager, out of her own pocket, was providing students in the residence with 1.2 minute noodles a day. Because for some other reason, I guess what the reason was, the students had not yet received their NSFAS funding from that institution. And so, from enrollment January, February, in May when we were there, the students were quite literally going hungry. When I visited another campus, and in fact I'm sure they won't mind, was again University of Venda, the health officials from the Student Health Center specifically asked to see me. And they said on a regular basis they have students fainting on campus in lectures, walking between lectures, and that is because the students are trying to exist on one helping of fruit juice concentrate a day, because they simply do not have money for food. And so this is a quote from the report, and I think it's worth reading to the Honourable Members. No student interviewed during the class visit admitted to being hungry, but several recounted stories about fellow students who were starving. Stories which were then confirmed by student leaders and student support staff. Given the stigma of poverty, the committee was of the view that these stories are merely the tip of the iceberg that is student hunger. It is an indictment on all who live in this country that some of the greatest talent of the next generation and many of its future leaders are being suffered to live and learn under such appalling conditions. It is not only the case that country's potential is being squandered, it is literally being starved. This state of affairs cannot be permitted to continue. It should be the first and most urgent priority of every stakeholder in higher education to ensure that it does not. The rationale for that, I think, is self-evident. A student who is starving cannot perform higher order functions by participating in academic activities. And I think it's actually dehumanizing to expect students to perform under such circumstances. While we're on this point, I want to pick up a point referred to by PG in the introduction, is that at a number of the institutions, as you saw in the slide, institutions decided to outsource their food services for a number of reasons. It is my view there was some contestation in the Ministerial Committee around this. But it is my view that unless institutions are providing students with access to at least one nutritious balanced meal a day, they are actually taking their responsibility to the student. And I want to suggest, along the lines of what the DE said, is that as a sector we need to really look into this issue of outsourcing. I think that the rationale for it in the past that we need to focus on core business, etc. I think history has shown that that was actually an incorrect decision. So I think that that is something that needs to be focused on in the sector. Okay, moving on then to the analysis of the findings. Over and over again, particularly on the historically disadvantaged campuses, we encountered this horrific side directly. And one had a sense of compassion for the decision makers at those institutions. Because on the one hand, feeling the call to throw open the doors of learning to as many as possible, certain decisions were made. For instance, reducing the residence fee to as low as possible to afford increased access. But on the other side, you then have the reality of that money is insufficient to actually maintain the residence, to provide the food that's needed so that the student can perform in the academic project. So you have a horrible dialectic that institutions, and particularly the historical advantage institutions, are facing. The second issue that we identified after the climate and carbon defining was that NISPLAC is being sadly well administered at a number of institutions. And that maladministration is translated directly into significant suffering and hardship by students at those institutions. And that also is a reason for students going hungry on a daily basis. We also noticed that the overwhelming majority of students and residents in the country in 2010 actually are receiving some form of financial assistance. Now that financial assistance is a lot more than that funding. We were able to get very clear data from the institutions in terms of categories of funding that is being received. 71% of students and residents do receive some form of financial assistance. Already mentioned is that the bulk of students and residents come from KZN, followed by the Eastern Cape, and then from Travis. I've mentioned the next point about the outsourcing of food services. The next bullet point is also a very interesting one. Across the country, we encountered resistance harm to student ratios. In other words, the management and administrative staff of student housing, ranging from one staff member to 19 students. In terms of the responses that we received from the institution, to 1 to 535. But in a presentation that I did 2 weeks ago to the sector, one student housing staff member cannot be needed. I have sole responsibility for 1,500 students. But I mean, with the best will in the world, honorable members, that is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. One staff member having the sole responsibility for 1,500 students is simply not sustainable. And again, obviously, the finding that the lack of sufficient and adequate on-campus housing is resulting in overcrowding, jeopardizing students' academic endeavors, and creating sufficient health and safety risks. That's obvious, or findings, if you like, based on the observation. But we also asked the institution to tell us the six maintenance and refurbishment backlog. Based on what institutions said to us, when we told them all our plans, they need, the sector is saying it needs 2.5 billion rand to refurbish the existing residences. Having been around now, I want to emphasize that I am not a building expert. I have obviously some experience, but I'm not a building expert. My view is that that is understated. I don't think that the institutions have the capacity to measure that accurately. But in my view, that 2.5 is understated. And then institutions will also ask, what do you need in order to modernize the residence? So, you know, do things like provide wireless internet access to students and residents. And they indicate a further 1.9 billion rand. You can see the big numbers starting to appear. In terms of trying to assess the backlog in the number of beds needed in the system. The committee debated this issue again, and we'll come to this slide later. But after a great deal of discussion, we determined that the shortage in 2010 was approximately 200,000 beds. We say that in order to address the issues that we observed in the site visits and arriving out of the questionnaire, we actually need to provide a further 200,000 beds, that's in 2010, to meet the backlog. As the DG mentioned, we are factoring in the growth in the sector. The cost of that, and this is based on a carefully assessed per bed cost of establishing suitable residence accommodation, 240,000 per bed, that translates into some 109 billion rand if we were to address that. And so given the magnitude of those numbers, in fact one of the models the cost projections were some 150 billion rand, which would lead for 10% of the national budget of South Africa. And so that gives rise to our finding that the private sector must play a key role in the provision of student housing. But, as the report emphasizes, currently the provision of student accommodation is totally unregulated, and the private sector is significantly abusing students. Hence the recommendation that the minimum standards needs to be debated. We are also saying that in terms of developing public-private partnerships, institutions must comply with National Treasury PPP regulations governing principles governing the establishment of public-private partnerships. Namely, is the project affordable, does provide value for money, and is there significant transfer of risk from public sector to the private sector? Right, I think we can then move on to the slide. This slide provides a breakdown of the existing stock in that column. It is the number of beds provided at those to the institutions in 2010. Sorry, that's the number of registered students. Then the number of beds per campus. Then giving you a percentage of the beds provided by that campus. In other words, what proportion of students registered at the university in 2010 can be housed in residence. And this is not the column of the significant ones because we identified, let's use CPUT as an example. You see, CPUT has four campuses. There's one in Cape Town, Wellington, and Mowbray. Now we say at those campuses, there is sufficient alternative accommodation in the area that can accommodate students without subjecting them to the kind of hardships that we've seen. So we say, in those instances, we want the university to be able to provide accommodation for 50% of their students. However, in Belleville, there is no suitable accommodation around Belleville campus. So in those instances, we are saying, actually, the university needs to provide student housing for 80% of the student body. And in fact, we debated that in the committee, and we felt our initial conclusion was given the kind of reality that we encountered, it should actually be 100%. But we felt, well, maybe that's not really the target for now. That's something to aim for in the future, let's pay this 80% for now, given the kind of realities that we encountered. And so if you go on to the next slide, you will see that we have done the 5,815 from. Okay. The next slide provides the average residence fee period 2006 to 2010, and you can see the wide range there. You can also see how few of the institutions in these three columns actually do provide meals to students. The NP indicates that those are institutions where food is not provided. The next slide, also an interesting slide, because this is a reflection of the financial reports provided by the institution relating to the kind of net result, if you like, of their resident operation. And you'll see up at the top, Victoria University, indicating that they generated those kinds of services. Down to the bottom, Exponential University of Technology, indicating that they have a very recent range of significant loss. So that's just to indicate the kind of range that we encountered. Okay, in terms of recommendations, as mentioned, we broke the campuses down into three types. Type 1, as I mentioned, these are the campuses identified where there is no suitable accommodation in the surrounding area. And those are campuses such as University of Limpopo, Joseph campus, Venda, Western Cape, Fort Hare, the other campus. Those are the institutions where we say we need to increase the bed capacity to 80%. Ideally, it should be 100%. Type 2 campuses are the campuses located in areas where there is limited off-campus accommodation, which is suitable. And we say those institutions need to move to providing 3% student accommodation. And type 3 campuses will then be the metro campuses, where there is the possibility of establishing the so-called student villages. Okay. We then move to the recommendations of the report, and I think I'll speed through them. We are making pretty strong recommendations around residence admission and allocation policies. So we found that that is an area that causes huge strife on campuses, where there are perceptions of, and whether those perceptions are real or not need to be tested, the perception of mismanagement, maladministration, and corruption are in the area. The third bullet point under number one are highlighted, and again want to emphasize the issue of the importance of making sure that across the sector the maximum number of first-year students can be occupied in residence. The second group of recommendations refers to minimum standards. There is a comprehensive minimum standard recommended in the report in the annexes, and that relates to regulating the kind of accommodation that the students need, and it will apply to not only to the public sector but also to private providers. So we are asking that this be gazetted and will be enforceable on providers of accommodation who provide student accommodation to 10 or more students. Number three is the issue of private student housing and accommodation. We're saying that the private sector is a very important partner in addressing these significant backdrops, but it must be regulated. While we are also trying to address the issue of the need for interdepartmental and interagency type relationship building. And quote as an example, at one of the institutions, building a new residence within a metro area, being required by the municipal bylaws to provide parking, because of the built-up nature of the particular location, the only parking that could be provided was underground parking. And so without this, this brand new facility, beautiful facility, but it is at an institution that services the poorest of the poor, of so you have this building with levels of underground parking that are absolutely unused. The cost of that pushed the per bed cost up by 50,000 per bed, which of course can translate into higher residency. And that's because of the municipal bylaw, which I would suggest could have been waived. We're also retaining, and this is important, the next good point is that the university should establish a board or council, and we're saying it should be composed of half students and half staff members. We encountered a lot of aggression on campuses because of the lack of communication between administrators or management and students. And if you have such a board where those kind of issues can be discussed and debated in a forum where the power relations are perceived to be relatively equal, is very important. So next six points are some evidence. Number five, again, is to emphasize that residences are not simply places where students sleep and eat. And we are playing the need for a great deal more research into the role that residences can play in enhancing the academic success of students. And in fact, at my own institution, we are making that claim that our residences play a significant role in helping us as an institution to achieve the kind of throughput rate that we do achieve. And at my institution, they are the highest in the country. And we do attribute the role of residences, or we do attribute the significant role of to the residences in achieving that. That first bullet point, we're saying it's very important to the institution, or for the institution, to separate the residence budget out from the central budget, because what we didn't encounter was quite a mush, and it's actually very difficult to try and test the performance of the residence system when everything's been mushed together like that. So I think we're recommending, if you like, almost like what's the word I'm looking for, a standard governance procedure to be applied in residences. The one issue that we have next point that we have also recommended is a wealth tax mechanism. Probably we shouldn't call it that much, cause a little bit of anxiety out there, but we're saying look at including as a line item in your residence budget, residence bursaries, so that students who can afford the fee are actually then contributing in some way to provide a residence bursary to those who cannot afford it. We are recommending that the NSFAS allocation for student housing should be standardized across the country and should be set at the minimum. And we are saying that in 2011, we calculated that it should be 30,500. And based on the model that was developed by the committee, we're saying that should provide the student with access to a well-managed, well-maintained residence, which includes two nutritious, balanced meals a day. Condition of residence infrastructure. I indicated that the university to ask self-assess. My own view is that they undertake that, hence that recommendation, that professional QS and engineer teams should assess this. Again, the emphasis on establishing national minimum standards for student housing. We did encounter an alternative methodology being proposed by a particular company, and the committee felt that that should be explored and fully researched. In terms of future planning, we are asking the institutions to develop multi-year strategic plans giving a financial backing for residents, maintenance and associates. We were quite staggered at the beginning of the time how few institutions had to do such things. And then finally was the issue of finding that at a number of institutions, the senior person tasked with looking after residences was in many instances not part of the senior management team, and in fact had no hand in formulating strategy, budget, or plans. And so we are suggesting or recommending that the chief housing officer at each institution should at least, at the very least, report directly to the senior manager. Member of the university. And so, I think that is the recommendation.
This is what the department has done in the report work. You will note that the minister is the report in February of this year. And since then, there have been a lot of engagement with a number of stakeholders in relation to the first part of this issue. What I need to emphasize is that over the next 3 years, the building infrastructure alone and the department will have 60 million to make available to institutions. And that money covers across, it covers a whole lot of infrastructure projects, not just those relating to student accommodation. But student accommodation is a key priority for the department, given some of the findings and some of the challenges that lie. And as a result, from that problem that we have over 3 years, and I need to emphasize that in terms of a funding cycle, it was only limited to 2 years. But the minister realizing that with 2 years you get only 3.8 million, it's not going to get too far. So the minister agreed to a 3-year funding cycle, which allowed us to include an extra 2.2 billion. So instead of just 3.8 billion over 2 years, we got 6 billion over 3 years. And from that 6 billion, almost 1.7 billion has been set aside specifically for student accommodation. But once again, we're not going to be treating all institutions the same. I mean, just remember the slide where Ian was showing on the left-hand side how some of the universities are performing in relation to accommodation, and on the right-hand side, some of the institutions that are not doing quite well. And on the right-hand side, Mr. Terry was historically disadvantaged institutions and in the main black institutions. So you could see that in terms of even how we're going to be allocating the money, 85% of that will be going towards addressing historically advantaged institutions to make sure that we do respond systematically to the challenges of life. Only about 15% will be going towards historically advantaged institutions. And we need to emphasize that one might say, why not allocate everything to historically disadvantaged institutions? But the reality is that the backlog covers the entire sector. And we need to make sure that those with a good balance can take the little that we provided and leverage additional funding from the private sector. And some of the institutions have already begun to do that. If you look at some of the residences that have been built over the last couple of years, institutions that have a good policy, they've managed to extract funding from the private funders. And the approach is quite simple. You cannot be providing just new residences without taking care of your old stock, because that in itself creates huge differentiation in the system. So while you make provision for new beds, you must also try to address some of the historical platforms. Because as Ian indicated, we need about 4.4 billion combined just for refurbishment and renovation. And therefore, we have to make sure that we don't cause differentiation between institutions where students would prefer to live in new residences at the expense of old residences. So the approach from the department is to take care of the new as well as the old at the same time. And then what we've done is that we've categorized institutions, and I'll explain the different categories in the next slide. But the podcast will be more on category A universities in terms of how we're going to be assessing them. And I think it needs to be said that if you look at the fees that they charge on residences, it's very low. And the private sector has not been very responsive because they said it's a huge risk. We give you loan for student housing, how are you going to pay them? Because, you know, you cannot just advance money without expecting a return on your investment. So government has to play a very critical role, particularly in assisting historically disadvantaged institutions. So what we've done is that we've engaged with the PIC, and we started on our engagement with the PIC, but they brought on board the DPSA because they say, look, it's too big a challenge for just one financial project point. So the DPSA, as part of the developmental mandate, has been brought on board to also assist. And what we want to do is to make sure that they categorize category A institutions. And in the main, those are historically disadvantaged institutions that have a rich balance sheet. I mean, their finances is not as strong as your category B and your category C institutions. And in the main, those are historically less institutions. Then in terms of category B universities, they also have limited options of accommodation, but their balance sheet is slightly better than your category A institution. So they can still access private funding. But in terms of our focus, the focus starts with category A institutions. Now the category C institutions are those that are running their residences and assessments. Their balance sheet is quite good, relatively good, and therefore we only provide this. But in terms of our focus, it will be largely on category A and to some extent category B institutions. Category C institutions have been able to leverage private funding, even in our departments, in that intervention. What we've done in terms of making sure that the recommendations are addressed, we recently had a workshop with all institutions, and we even invited some of the key stakeholders, some of the private service providers when it comes to accommodating, even attended the workshop. Because in terms of the guidelines, in terms of the norms and standards, they won't be only applicable to on-campus accommodation, but they'll also be applicable to off-campus accommodation. So they had an opportunity to even engage with the department during the workshop. We even invited the PIT and DBSA and APA side funders to come and engage with the university so that we can explore viable options of financing student accommodation. And universities, as well as other stakeholders, have been given until the 25th of this month to comment in terms of the intention of the department to gather the minimum norms and standards. So the sector has been consulted. They also have an opportunity to engage further after the workshop and provide inviting some of their comments in relation to the minimum norms and standards. We intend that before the end of this financial year, this minimum norms and standards will be undertaken. But also as a department, we need to play a more proactive role in terms of not just student accommodation, but infrastructure within the sector. So internally, we are establishing a project management unit, and we're building capacity so that we can assist some of the institutions that have not been doing particularly well in relation to student accommodation, as well as other infrastructure priorities. And then we also want to compel universities to provide for maintenance. It's quite odd that nowadays when you buy a car, it comes with a 5-year maintenance plan. And when you build infrastructure, some of the institutions, when we engage with them, make no provision for maintenance. Immediately when you provide a new building, there's additional operating costs because you need people to clean it, you need people, you need to provide for amenities. So some of these institutions that require this infrastructure do not have a clear plan in terms of how they're going to be maintaining it. And I think it was quite alarming that when we undertook our site visit last year, because we went to all 23 universities and said, this is the money that has been allocated by the department over the last couple of years. Can we see the infrastructure that you are building? Because traditionally they've been reporting that to the department in terms of submitting progress reports and audit certificates. But we said we needed far more than this. We needed to go to those institutions and inspect some of the infrastructure. And when we did our inspections, we were quite alarmed that some of the new infrastructure you know, there was even a debate that this is something very good to me, particularly when you relate to student accommodation. And it's lastly because of quality. The room has been built for two students, and you end up accommodating three students in that group. You can imagine what it does to that infrastructure. So what you also have to do is to also systematically map the needs of the system. Now, universities have largely responded to the report as well as the call for infrastructure money that we made. But it is the department that needs to be matching the needs of the system. It is the department that needs to be playing a leading role in terms of how we provide infrastructure money. But just to highlight to the chair as well as the honorable member that it's not only about student housing that we focus on. It's not only on student accommodation. There's other infrastructure priorities for the country. And over and above the funding that is made available for student housing, we've also provided for addressing some of the historical backlog. And some of the historical backlog will also have to do with the provision of health services. Because a number of historically disadvantaged institutions have said, we can build new residences, but if we don't take care of our health services, we're going to be having a serious problem. And some are saying we need to create our facilities because there's nothing much for the students to do over the weekend. So we've made provision not only for student housing but for also addressing some of the historical backlog within our institutions. Engineering, we need more engineers as a country. Therefore, we cannot be just focusing on some of the infrastructure priorities without looking at what the country needs. So we've made funding for engineering, we've made funding for health sciences, we've also made funding for teacher education. So those are some of the priorities where we've allocated funding. But most importantly, we've also made funding available for project management at universities. Because 5 years from now, we would want to make sure that the 6 billion that we set aside, the infrastructure is well maintained and it provides value for money. So universities, when we build in capacity, must be also at an institutional level. Because some universities, when engaged with them, they admitted that they don't have project management capacity. And project management capacity comes at a cost. But over the lifetime of those infrastructure projects, it pays for itself. Institutions that are spending on project management are doing exceptionally well when it comes to the delivery of infrastructure. So those are some of the key issues that we thought it's important to share with the chairperson as well as the honorable member in terms of how we've addressed the challenges. But over and above that, I'd also like to highlight on some of the issues that
I'm going to just let me just take this opportunity to thank the community of Chalame and the department for the work that you have done
Thank you. end up as we think. But at that time, we do not look into where actually students want to be accommodated. So in going forward, then also these things would be the only thing, because the issue in the budget for 50 and then come 300. And then where do you do this? So that's why in this budget, what we need on the the other thing is on the CPO that the budget is concerned. Say WM once told us that different kinds of different policies find a body of contact in housing, including safety rights, in two state data rights, in Northern Cape, APEC. Have you looked into the risk of the service program in facing the crisis, at the same time we will not get the day of what to work. Is there any feeling that you can take this in this money that you find yourself in? Also, you are saying you're connecting the students, is the question of autonomy one also be affecting the way it works? They are now interfering with their autonomy. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. If my colleagues ask me just to ask the first question from each side, and it was about the NSFAS funding. And you said that, you know, some of the timing is like 4 months late. So the students can't get, they don't have money for free, etc. Now, I was just trying to find out the problem. But the problem lies with the administration part of the university, or with NSFAS. You know, where does the problem lie? Is the money in place of the university, but that's the administration on that part? If it doesn't get to the students. So that's the first question. The second one, I just wanted to make sure, because we were talking about regulating private accommodation. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I might be wrong, but there's no way that you can regulate private on accommodation. I mean, if I go to say that I want to rent up, no one will tell me how to regulate it. You know, there's no way of regulating it, because there's no body to regulate the private person or entity to rent up the rent up we want to actually. So I think we must look at that. Then we kind of oversight at the Walter Tisiba University a while ago, and we looked at some of those places where students stay, and some of them were actually not bad, and then just like next door, it didn't prevent. So, you know, it's also like the attitude of some students that look after it and other teams not after it in the same area. And then we must also look at the infrastructural maintenance. As it seems like there's some buildings that you can actually renovate and some which is actually so far that you should build a new one. You can't actually renovate it anymore. So I think we must just look at that as well. Because we, you know, you're not spending money on places which can't be renovated, which is rather be rebuilt. And then, well, the management of the state funds that goes to the university. We've seen, for instance, at Walter Sulu, where money, I'm talking about state money that's obviously going to the university, as it was spent left, right, and centre by all the smaller parts of the university, then it added to eventually they said, well, stop this money, it's being spent everywhere. It should be spent from a central point of view where someone's got control over the money. Now, we would also like to know that when government gives money to a university, that it obviously gets spent widely towards this. So tender procedures on renovating, etc., etc. And, I think that's it.
Thank you, Honorable Baba. Before you, Honorable Lucky, I want to say a question that we should not, like, be focused. Just the one thing which might be just to say. This is the finding in the community.
So I think when we engage, we should take in mind that these are the recommendations that they put before us and the findings.
Rather, I have a comment that I would like to make.
when they saw the situation of the accommodation of the contractors, have they ever made any record or any ever wrote something on the status of the accommodation, or was it for the first time that you referred
will do our part within the framework and the instruction of this art. I think that one is very clear. Because we're talking about something like 150 kilograms, it's not a small thing. And one hand. Now, the view of calculating standards is wrong. Whether the accommodation is solicited or rendered from the private individual or one, is absolutely to say, if a university is to acquire private accommodation, achieve the certain standards within which every provider would have to operate within and meet those requirements. So that when you are buying this service at the university, at least you cannot buy services of a particular low standard. You would rather not acquire that service. Very important are all the providers of the service as to whether they could meet that requirement, that certification by the university or not. In actual fact, you are not necessarily regulating a private property. You are regulating our character in terms of when you are acquiring private property, at least the building that you will acquire should meet this minimum standard and not. So that's how we are actually doing it. We are not taking terms to any individual, but we want to ensure that this any accommodation which is used for the purposes of housing our own children is of an acceptable standard. That's the intensity. The increasing of privacy is what it is. I think this is part of corrupt practices that are actually out there, and it's something that we have to deal with as such. And there are mechanisms and measures that we can take with. I think the question of regulating private accommodation, I think I'll cover that. Now, how reliable the research was, I think the honorable member admitted that he came a bit late because that would actually be explained by going through the presentation again as to how the research was conducted. I will leave that to correct the which universities need serious attention. I think they have also been clarified. The historical disadvantage and historical advantage. This is not a formulation of a concept by the department as such. The question of historical advantage and historical disadvantage is as a result of the evolution of the history of the country. And that in actual fact was developed with a view of actually taking into consideration as what are the measures that need to be put in place in order to address the question of research, equity, as well as leveling the playing field. The critical question then, I think, which is in front of us as a country, has been able to adequately address these historical features structurally that are characterizing our country, our society today. Because it's not something which is only unique to university. It's something which is actually cutting across our entire society, our entire country. What we need to do. And for that, we actually get guidance from the lawmakers in terms of the assessment as to where, in regard to the question of equity and the risk, which is informed by the structural features of our path. How far have we gone in that regard? But in regard to the system, in regard to the system, that is the university, it's quite clear that the universities that are located in rural areas in the main they are the most ones that are affected by this anomaly. Because there is no adequate transport infrastructure, there is no adequate transport facilities that are available. So students are actually forced to be at the university. There is no profile rental facility that can be available, and there are no houses in terms of communities that are in the surrounding, whereby persons wake up at his or her own home, go to a university, and come back. That is the nature and the structure of the system, basically. And the question of looking at the resources as well. They are the most trusted universities. Other universities, for instance, they will have reserves in their balance. But in this, you find that they are actually in the red, not a normal situation. For instance, what are the people are talking about? There are over 200 million over that facility. They cannot service anymore. To a point whereby it becomes difficult to pay salaries and credit cards. So the situation varies. It's a painful situation when you confront it, you know, on the daily basis. Because the same time being there, you are supposed to produce things. And it breaks your heart, I must say. It breaks your heart when you are out there. And that asks, you know, yourself questions that you do not have answers to. But these are the matters that we have been to some elements of the things.
Thank you, Van Terry. I'll respond to the issues relating to the research of the report, and then we'll hand over the talking for responses to my colleagues. In terms of food, the first question that you asked, the committee has provided in the report a comprehensive menu that we have copied. It has been set by a registered dietitian, and we've copied it based on the honourable member deputy chair from Eastern Cape. We've copied based on Eastern Cape diet, which, as you're aware, consistently is a province that has a higher inflation rate than the other provinces. And yet, if the honourable members look at the menu that we have provided, you'll see that based on the model that we have developed, by the way, this is not a theoretical model. It is being provided currently at an institution. And you'll see that we are saying it should have been able in 2010 to provide, for instance, let's take one of them, beef casserole with rice and vegetables. That meal we should be able to provide to the students for 40 men. Okay? The point that honourable members have made, we encounter situations in rural provinces where excellent providers were asking for 40 men for a cake of food. I mean, that is, it's criminal, it's unethical. So the committee did interrogate this issue, and we then have a look at sector, you can do it. And here's a model that is not just theoretical, it is real. That's the food issue. Which, by the way, also relates to the question around outsourcing. I think this model is based on an in-source campus food services. And it is well managed, it is well run, very effectively run. And I also want to point out that in terms of the staffing structure of the unit that is producing this, it is in a rural sector or location. And because of the location, it is providing a significant, or making a significant contribution to the GDP in that area. And so if that institution were outsourced, and bring in one of these private providers, the first thing that the private provider do would be to cut staff in half, you know, in the interest of increasing profit for shareholders. Okay? So, as I say, where is the sponsor relief that we have provided? In terms of critical buildings at the moment, we didn't encounter any situation other than one or two institutions where they had entered into relationships with other departments, such as the Department of Health, and we're using some of the Department of Health buildings that previously housed, for instance, nurses. And so Public Works was playing a role in assisting with refurbishment of those buildings. But that was a very small percentage in the country. Largely, my understanding is that residences, the traditional model of the residences belong to the university. They actually own. Of course, other than all campus accommodation. Now, can I imagine some points about cheap housing options that are needed to honor the strategic planning capabilities of institutions? We did observe that there's a huge problem there, but we find that, and I've said this with due respect to the top colleagues at the institution, the decisions that get made, for instance, around about July, August, that our enrollment must increase. But then since the institution's housing office is saying, find us accommodation for the next year's enrollment. So the chief housing officer has got no benefits that you go up and forth, for instance, and only use the hotel. Now, I didn't show you the pictures of some of the hotels, for instance, that have been used for student accommodation. It is simply abominable. One has a major facility for the student housing officer who's got no alternative. You've got to find some accommodation, you've got to find some accommodation. And so you should take whatever is available. So that is that horrible dialogue that we spoke about. Which leads me to the question about the drug laws, etc. It, one of the recommendations in the report is to leave the university to be very careful about the type of location of accommodation. Now, particularly in the Durban area, accommodation is being forced that it's in a highly undesirable area, where the students are exposed to enormous risks like drug dealing, prostitution, gangsterism. It is horrific. But it's not restricted to those kinds of accommodations. We didn't come to situations around the country where residences are, the local community has good access to the residences because of the breakdown in the security of the residences, which is a point of concern. Regardless, I've answered the different crises in the different provinces. I'll touch on this one. My colleagues might have answered the issue of university autonomy. I have to say that in my practice, encountering the, or meeting with the bystanders, I think they reach the stage where they recognize, you know what, there's a problem. There's a big problem, and we need to assist. That was my, I didn't encounter a single hostile reception from any institution that recognized, you know, being held. Regulations of private accommodation and DT is addressed that. But I just want to point out, in the report what we have recommended, we realize that you can't enforce that legislation without some kind of enforcing agency. But what we are suggesting is that the university needs to take responsibility for accrediting accommodation using minimum standards. Then the university can send any nurse-type funded students to unaccredited accommodation. Okay, so we thought that's quite an easy way because it's obviously going to convert the private provider in the office. And as we well know, private providers are meant for money. So if you're not going to get students, and by the way, we believe that the bulk of the growth in students is going to come in from our four-person community,
you won't get students coming to take up your accommodation and then you've been credited according to the minimum standards.
Absolutely agree with the point made that don't renovate you to children. I think that would be a standard way to take a move. Take money in query administered. I think this is why the report is calling for institutions to provide a comprehensive and coherent plan for student housing in those institutions, including a financial plan. The issue of high level was the research. We did during crisis, we did attempt to triangulate the data provided by the nation. And we gained very useful insight from that. Out of 2010, we paid serious attention. As I said in my introduction, the fact is, without looking, one could say, without having been born into the old apartheid state, one would have to say there is a clear divide between this kind of record, this kind of institution, and that state. And then we are interrogated, that is the reality. Not an absolute.
people might be able to leverage higher detector and get it quite low or slightly higher. But interestingly, that is the natural average for testing. And we feel that to go in significantly lower than that, you're actually going to again reiterate the mistakes of the past.
Just quickly on a few other questions that were also mentioned in the she wanted to think specifically about the management of that kind of universities that came to be. Just very quickly, on average, universities need about 40% size funding. It does vary from university to university. It can be 80% size of the university, but that's the average. There are other sources of data, including grant funding, research, and so forth. And ideally, about it should be the team that comes that's responsible for the budget, two by council, tend to manage. There are different models of universities can decentralize the management of the budget, the funding to different faculties, and so forth. But I think the honorable member that guides this is the list of the offices to the university, but without going into much detail, I think there is a very much different challenge that we had as part of the actual mergers that have not been properly managed. So that's probably the direction of funding all over that must be managed centrally. The
to come back to the members to Parliament and explain
how that kind of one thing. So the issue of autonomy comes before that, because we're dealing with party funds. And just to emphasize this point, next week, Monday, we will be going to the University of Johannesburg, and for the first time, the department will be involved in the tender committee. So we're getting involved into understanding how universities procure services, because if we don't get it right yet, we might as well forget about this money. So the point I wanted to emphasize is that there's an expectation to do more because of public funds. And once again, in terms of installation of prices, I need to emphasize that project management, and I talked about project management in relation to both at an institutional level and at a departmental level. Because we've seen that institutions that may have a good project management team, they can look at the price escalation. You know how much it costs to certain good certain services. Therefore, if you've got quantity surveyors, if you've got a team of experts on your team, it's very easy to manage that. It is expensive to people to people, but like I said, the cost pays for itself, because you can manage your project, you can make sure that you're not charged over and above what the market thinks. And I also need to emphasize that before 2010, prices in terms of infrastructure were inflated. Universities are coming to us and say, we managed to save. And we say not good, you know, so you can see that there's value for money. And what we need to do is that project management team that will be established in the department is to make sure that it's not only one or two institutions that come back to us and say, we've managed to save. And I think another thing that we also need to factor is that there's an issue of heritage when we deal with particularly universities that have infrastructure over 60 years, because you cannot just renovate or build, you know. And that in itself does delay some of the costs. And those delays do result in cost escalation. So in some cases, it's not just artificial cost inflation. It's a result of delays. And some universities have even admitted that it takes so long to even get our plans approved by the local municipality. The department would like to assist where possible. That is why we're getting involved in each and every aspect, not just looking at the outcome, but also looking at how universities structure and go about the project management. So the issue of NSFAS in particular, because NSFAS, I think from the one of the presentations was that 71% of students are on financial aid. And I mean, NSFAS for the financial year will be disbursed in 7.5 billion. So you can see that the majority of that 71% is saved. It's government that provides through NSFAS. And if we don't get it right in terms of administration, we're not getting a good return on our investment. Those are some of the questions that I thought were not answered. I think the DG and my other colleagues have responded to. Let's talk about all of this.
Can I just clarify that our interest in have an understanding as to what is happening in regard to autonomy at an institutional level. It's not to say we are actually there to take all responsibility for wrong decisions that have been made. I want to clarify that. But we are there in order to understand the system they put in place so that we could be able to know basis and develop what could be an appropriate to mitigate the risk that we could identify in the law. We are not there as decision makers. I wanted to clarify that if now comes out this particular university has taken a wrong decision, department was there, then it becomes no automatic part of that. Yeah, it's questioning that.
and the issue of, I'm taking
because we do have so much, like, for example, we still have a school in the system. But if you go to the school and say, thank everyone, he doesn't help us. Because there are no more to start, but really one thing, really, I think that is a good move for my mother. The issue of private accommodation, I think, just the next, for example, if you talk about hotel support, they rent out, you know, buildings from individual people, like, therefore, specific, this is what we want to do, help to introduce your buildings. I think we're still in the record, and maybe there is maybe. But the last question, I'm more interested, maybe, if you can speak, something that you're bringing to the issue of Botswana, because I'm from the Northwest, I know that the campus is not working with in Mabigay, therefore, this,
Thank you.